Podcasting from the beautiful San Francisco Bay Area in California, this is Venus Rising, where we discuss all things related to big fertility and encourage you to think beyond the masses. I'm Callie Fell, your host, bringing you the best and most up-to-date conversations on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health. Hello, and welcome back to Venus Rising. I'm your host, Callie Fell. Today, we have the privilege of hearing from fertility fraud advocate and author, Eve Wiley. Eve, originally from a small rural town in East Texas, uncovered a life-changing family secret about her genetic identity. In 2019, she shared her story to expose the dark side of the grossly unregulated fertility industry. Eve's story, documented by ABC's 2020, thrust her into an advocacy role to raise awareness on fertility fraud and negligence. She has successfully lobbied to change the laws in many states to protect those using artificial and reproductive technologies and continues to advocate for more accountability within the industry. I'm really excited to talk with her today. So without further ado, Eve, welcome to Venus Rising.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah. So you have proclaimed that you are a product of fertility fraud. So what is fertility fraud? Can you break that down for our listeners?
Absolutely. So fertility fraud is a very narrow definition that is for when a doctor or a nurse or a medical professional knowingly misrepresents the genetic DNA or any type of reproductive material. So for example, it is when a doctor inseminates his own sperm inside of a woman without her knowledge or consent. But it is not to be confused with fertility negligence, which would mean because there are not protocols and procedures into place that someone accidentally grabs the wrong genetic material and uses that. And so those two get conflated pretty quickly. And so that's a great question to really make sure that that they're not confused.
Yeah, yeah. So how common is this? Because I mean, that's like crazy to think that I'm going in for fertility treatment, let's say, and I think that my egg is going to be combined with my husband or partner's sperm, and instead the doctor uses his own. Is that kind of what we're talking about?
That's exactly what we were talking about. And the honest answer is we don't know. We have a survey from the 1980s where 2% of doctors reported using their own sperm in their own patients. And we have that. We have anecdotal evidence of me and other victims uncovering over 70 doctors that have done this in the world. But because we don't have a national or international reporting system, we don't even know how many donor-conceived people there are in the United States.
Right.
And so we don't really have a clear picture of how many doctors did this. A lot of these cases are settled in non-disclosure agreements. So just like sexual assault cases, those cannot be overturned. So it's not like we can even like back end our way into this by looking up court records to see how many of these cases have been settled. And the reality of it is that we are only figuring out this dark side of the fertility industry and hopefully what is just a stain and is no longer happening because of commercial DNA testing. It was an unintended consequence of commercial DNA testing. And what I mean by that is you can now spit into a tube and then $49 later, you are connected with 3,000 of your closest relatives. And so, yeah, that's just kind of, that is a back end way of getting to this.
Yeah. And with those non-disclosure agreements, even the victims can't speak out, right? Because they're silenced by the agreement.
Exactly. And so it's really frustrating for victims of fertility fraud. I mean, really for anyone, when you are faced with very limited choices, one choice is that non-disclosure agreement. Money will never make this right, but it is, quite frankly, the only way to hold these men accountable. A lot of time, these doctors, they were doing this to save money. They were doing this because they didn't have access to a fresh sample or to a live donor. They didn't want to pay shipping cost for a cryobank. We know that like most of these cases are stemming from the 80s and 90s. So, you know, there are limitations there. So it's one way to hold them accountable. It'll never, you know, make it okay. The other option is to do nothing. And then the third option is to come forward. And that is not always easy. Coming forward and the most private, traumatizing thing to happen to you and then living that out front stage of the world. That's not for everyone.
I can't imagine the just the feelings that arise when you go on to Ancestry or 23andMe for fun and then kind of figure out like, wait a second, this isn't what I was expecting. And I've spoken with others who weren't victims of fertility fraud per se, but they found out this way that they were a product of artificial, you know, rather
donor
than
conception.
Yeah, donor conception. Exactly. Sorry. And they found out dad isn't who they thought dad was, and things start to make a little bit more sense when they, once they're able, if they are able to meet their biological family.
Right.
So I want to ask you how this impacts a person's life, because we're talking about that. But I think rather than start there, do you mind sharing just kind of your story and going into a little bit more detail?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm from a really small town in East Texas. We're talking like rural America on a farm. The closest hospital was in Nacogdoches, Texas, and that was about 30 miles away. So my parents, they were older. I believe the technical term for my mother would have been of advanced maternal age at 35, which I find so offensive, but whatever.
Right.
So because she was of advanced maternal age and things just, you know, they were getting pregnant. They consulted with Dr. Kim McMorris of Nacogdoches, Texas, fertility doctor. And they looked at my father, Doug. They looked at his sperm and there was secondary male infertility factor. And he had, what's it called, varicose veins around the testes. But there is a procedure that can make that better, right? So he had the procedure. He was giving samples, still no motility. So Dr. McMorris was like, hey, why don't you use a sperm donor? And the thinking at the time was, use a sperm donor. You're never going to tell the child the truth of their genetic identity. They're never going to find out unless you tell them. It's just not important. Now, we obviously know better now, but that was the thinking at the time. So they handed my mom and dad one sheet of paper from California Cryobank, and it had all these different donors. You know, it's a much different experience now where it's like an a la carte menu of add voice recording and add this.
So you go online and you're like finding a match.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's wild how just, you know, different it is. And so there's one line, it gives physical characteristics, interest, level of education, blood type. And so they circled donor 106 and then wrote this one on it. And it was interesting, well, looking back now, the donor that they picked to be my biological father was the exact opposite to my father. And my dad, Doug, he was really tall, olive skin complexion, mathematics was his thing. Obviously different blood type. And the donor they chose was into politics and religion, blonde hair, blue eyes. I mean, just like, I don't know why, but my mom was like, I didn't want to constantly be wondering if I run into someone, is that her biological father? And so like, I kind of get it from the rationale, but it was just, it's still fascinating to me. So they chose that donor. They go in. She gets inseminations over and over and over again, and they're finally pregnant with me. So I'm born, I'm 4 months old, and they are naturally pregnant with my little sister. Yeah. And so I just think that maybe they didn't give the procedure long enough to work, but you know, we could sit there and process it all day.
Right.
So I have a little sister who's 14 months younger and is the biological child of my dad, Doug. And is also the polar opposite to me. And so it was interesting growing up because I legitimately thought that I was maybe adopted or maybe a product of an affair. There was this thought unknown to me. Like I knew there was a secret. I just didn't know that I was the secret. And so Doug, my dad, he passed away when I was 7 years old. Wow. And my mom's a nurse. And she was like, my little sister, Joanna, well, now she has to go get heart echoes every year. And there are these medical things that we really have to, you know, for cardiomyopathy and all those things that she needs to be aware of. And my mom's thinking was, I know Eve is not his biological child, even though they were mixing the sperm. And, you know, that's a whole other, you know, the male ego is so fragile sometimes. She's like, what has come up for Eve? Everybody is healthy when they're 18 years old for the most part. But as that donor grew older, you know, what came up? And so for her, she just started collecting information. This was around the time that Donor Sibling Registry was getting started with Wendy Kramer. Mm-hmm. This was, you know, this was like the era of Yahoo Messenger boards. And so, you know, there weren't really like books and there wasn't a manual on how do you navigate this. So my mom was going on Yahoo Messenger. She was emailing and talking with people. The donor conceived group as a whole was not even remotely organized because it was newer, right? You know, it wasn't like the adoption community who had all these, you know, they already went through their fights and created, you know, their system. And so she was printing out all of these emails and just trying to get as much information as possible. She was contacting California Cryobank. She knew that his religion was of Baha'i faith. So she was, it was literally emailing, calling the Baha'i temples. I'm not probably not even saying that right. In California, like, hey, does anybody in your congregation like match this description?
Wow.
So my mom was going crazy.
So she was trying to find your donor so that she could help identify maybe any medical after mm-hmm. seeing what happened to your dad, Doug.
Right.
She wanted to make sure you were going to be safe. And right. Is that what I'm following?
Right. And I think that there was a part of her where she eventually started to feel like she took away my right to have a biological father. And I think that, you know, when she talks about it now, she talks about the tunnel vision of infertility. And at the time when infertility wasn't talked about and infertility wasn't seen as a grieving process. And so there weren't support systems in place. And so for her, she was like, I couldn't really tell you when you were seven, because what do you say? Oh, your dad died, but that's not like your real dad because there's this other person, like there's donor conception. Oh, you don't know what sex is. Oh, you don't use. It was just
right. Awful. Right.
You know, a whole lot. Like, I get it. Yeah. So he was like, but you're grieving for your dad. So it was just like, whoa. And so for her, she was collecting all this information. So when I turned 18, she was going to give me this green folder. And that was the protocol for California Cryobank. When you turn 18, you could submit the insemination records. They will cross-check it with the purchasing records from the doctor, and then they will make the match. They will reach out and try and find the donor, update his medical information. If you guys want to chat, great, we'll connect you. And that was their process. So my mom's a school nurse. I am a teenager who's snooping. I'm bored. And so I kept going, I just had a habit of going through my mother's emails. I just did. And so again, I think it goes back because I always felt like there was something I was missing. And so yeah. I was like, I guess I'm just going to uncover it. And boy, did I. So I'm going through my mom's emails. I see all this stuff over artificial insemination, which was never weird to me because rural America, farm girl, like, what is my mom doing with my grandpa's cows? Like,
right. Exactly.
That's just normal.
Right.
And so it's like from California. I was like, that's weird. Like, we never get cows from California. And so I click on it and I'm reading it. And then I see my birth date at the bottom. And it was just like, whoa, hold on. I know what artificial insemination is. That's my birthday. But that was the moment, right? That was mm-hmm. the moment of, I knew there was a secret. I just didn't know that I was a secret. So all of those burdens that were not mine to bear, it was like, it was lifted, you know, I don't have to worry about heart disease. I don't know, but in this capacity, I don't.
Right.
And then there was this very naive 16-year-old Eve that was like, oh my gosh, I still have a dad. And so I think that for me, which is different from a lot of people's who are donor conceived, or they find out that a non-parent expected result or misattributed parentage, you know, anybody in that demographic. For me, I didn't have that infertile parent to be protective of. So what I mean is, if Doug were alive, maybe I would have felt like I needed to be more protective of that relationship. But because I didn't have that, I felt mm-hmm. full, you know, free rein mm-hmm. to pursue this in any capacity. And, you know, genetic identity has always been really important to me. I think that, you know, especially now when I really think about this, and I get so annoyed when people talk about like, well, what about the privacy of the donor? And it's like, nowhere in this entire equation did anyone think about the existential transaction of all of this, which is the child that grows into an adult who has feelings, wants, and desires. And I think that's so unfair.
And rights.
This is a fundamental human right, is to know who you are. It is the foundation of identity formation, of all of these things. And for people to agree with that in some capacity, but then this situation be different because we need to respect the donor's privacy. No. Privacy is me not telling you something about me. Secrecy is you not telling me something about me. And those are different.
Yeah.
And we know what family secrets do. And then now anonymity is dead with commercial DNA testing.
It's dead.
And so as it should be, what it does is, and this is what I talk to parents a lot about, is when you are not being honest with your child, you are reinforcing the narrative that their existence is somehow shameful. You think you are protecting them. You are not. You're setting them up for a complex and failure. And it is your projection as a parent and what you are feeling uncomfortable with instead of honoring their experience. Because at one time, you valued to have a child of at least 50% genetics. That's why you chose this over adoption. You must also value and desire or value that child who grows into adult, their desire to know the other 50% genetics. It's not mutually exclusive for one narrative. And I don't think it's fair that the fertility industry, they just keep going with that narrative. So anyway, I'm going to step off that soapbox. So, because I can keep going on that one, let me tell you. So from finding that out, I went and I confronted my mom. And I was like, Mom, I know Doug's not my dad. And she just started bawling. And so walked through that whole thing. And at the time, I wasn't mad at her because I think that, you know, I was excited that I have the truth. And I'm really not adopted, or not even being adopted is a bad thing, but like, you know, all those things that everyone's told me my whole life, that there was just, you know, a little bit of truth to that. So we worked and we waited until I was 18. And then we submitted my mom's medical records to California Cryobank. And it took them about a year. And what they were doing is they were mailing donor 106, update your medical records, update your medical records. And, you know, they're trying to find him. It took about a year. And they called me and they're like, we found him. We have your medical records. And I told them, here's this email letter. Please forward it to him. And it was your typical, like, which is kind of cringeworthy now. Hi, my name is Eve. I'm mentally stable, financially, like, secure. Like, don't leave. Like, talk about an abandonment wound, right? Like, you've got one chance. Don't mess it up. Like,
right. And to feeling like you had to, like, say, I'm not coming after you for any particular reason. Yes. I just want to know you.
Right. But, like, but no validation. And, like, that's okay. And that's normal, but you just got to make sure you don't sound crazy. Like, so messed up, like the bare minimum, as if me asking to speak to him or to meet him or have a relationship is this huge burden, you know, like once again, I'm bearing burdens that are not mine to bear. Mm-hmm. And he's wonderful and he is amazing. And I am so, so, so lucky because he was just as excited as I was. And so we're emailing and then we're on the phone. And then a month later, he's flying to Austin where I was in college and we're meeting for the first time. And then after that meeting, we were walking from dinner and we ran into someone I knew on the street. And I was like, this is my dad. I wasn't even thinking. I was like, this is my dad, Steve. And after that, he was like, hey, I really like that. I'm okay with that if you want to call me dad. And I was like, okay. So he is dad. And so when I chose to get married, he officiated our wedding. My kids call him Papa, holidays. I mean, all the thing, like he is his dad. And I recognize that that is a very different experience for most people, but it was very much a fairy tale experience. But like most fairy tales, there is a dark twisted turn and mine was no different. So I had my first son, Hutton. And he was presenting with all these medical mysteries and the doctors could not figure out what was going on. A lot of them thought, oh, you're a first time mom. It's a different soapbox of mine. But he was vomiting.
So somehow you must be naive. Sorry.
I know. Right. But you knew where that was going.
Yeah.
So, it was a whole thing. Oh, and we ended up working with this geneticist who does more of like kind of functional medicine. You could have told me to go stand outside naked in the rain and stand upside down and do whatever, I would have done it if it would have fixed my kid. And so our team was missing it. It wasn't making sense. So he says, do 23andMe. It's the easiest way for him to get genetic data on him for like variants for an expression, raw data. I don't know, whatever it was, he needed that data. I was like, whatever. From talking with California Cryobank, I knew that I would have siblings, but I think it was the age I was at in my 20s. I mean, obviously I was so focused on my sick child. They told me I was one of the older ones. So I think in my head, I was like, siblings were not on my radar, basically.
Right.
Commercial DNA testing was newer. Mm-hmm. 23andMe was really new. Mm-hmm. And so we do it. We meet with him and he's like, hey, Hutton has celiac disease. And I'm like, what is celiac disease? I have no idea what that is. And so they go through the whole education process of like, you know, the gluten and the, you know, all the things, the autoimmune disorders. I had never heard that word before. And so he's like, someone in your family, Eve, because this genetic mutation is coming from your side. So I'm like, well, that's weird. So I go, I talk to my mom, no one. I talk to Steve, dad, no one has anything like that. And, you know, cognitive dissonance is a wonderful thing because that's really red flag number one, right? So I was like, all right, whatever. We get Hutton okay. That's all I care about. That's fine.
Yeah.
And then I start getting these matches on like the ancestry type matches. And I had already done ancestry.com too at this point. And I don't know if you're, I'm sure you're familiar with how you read the websites, because at the time I was not. I didn't know what a Centimorgan was. I was just like, oh, if that says that's my first cousin, then that's my first cousin. You know, I didn't realize that, you know, if you have 1,200 Centimorgans, that could be four different things, you know, degrees of which you're related. So that could be an uncle, a half sibling, a parent, you know, it could be, you know, whatever it is. So I was just assuming that these were my first cousins. And then I got to thinking, well, that's weird because my mom has two brothers. They don't have biological children. Oh my God, did I discover a love child? Like, oh, there's like, you know, ooh, a new family secret. And then dad has two siblings, but they don't have biological children either. I'm like, oh, whose family secret is this? So I'm talking with her, and it was when I was talking to my mom that she was like, Eve, those could actually be your half siblings. And I was like, what? So I go back and look and I connect with the first one. He's 13 years older than I am. Well, that doesn't make any sense because I'm supposed to be one of the older ones.
Right.
And so, but he's talking about how he is donor conceived. He's known it, but I'm still so excited. I have a brother. This is so cool. And then I'm like, oh man, dad and I have like, you know, we have a pretty special relationship. I don't want to be the middleman into this relationship. Right. So I called dad and was like, hey, I need you to get on 23andMe or Ancestry. I just want you and whoever to have that, that medium, that platform to speak with.
Sure.
That way it's not me projecting our experience onto them. And I just want to be out of it, you know?
Yeah.
And so he did. And then I look at the next one and I call him and he's actually from Nacogdoches. And I was like, well, I guess it's not too weird if it was the same doctor. And bless his sweet little heart. He's just not the brightest crayon in the box. And we're talking and he's like, no, Kim McMorris is our dad. I'm like, no, he's the doctor. Like our moms went in for their procedure. Like, it's a little different, but I'm like, just bless your heart. Okay. And it, you know, it was great. And then I'm connected with the third one, who was really hard to track down. And cause everybody else is on social media, but I found him on LinkedIn and I'm sending him these messages. It's late at night. And he's like, I think it's going to be a little weird. You know, how do I explain to my wife that it was 11 PM this time? I'm going to get out of bed and I got to go talk to this woman. Like, can we just talk tomorrow? And I was like, okay, yeah, that's fine. I just think I'm your half sister.
No big deal. No big deal.
No big deal. Sweet dreams. Talk to you tomorrow.
Who can sleep after that sort of, you know?
No, my phone immediately rings. He's like, okay, you have my attention. I was like, I was just going to rip the Band-Aid off. I'm like, so here I am thinking like, you know, we go through the whole thing. It says we're first cousin, close family to first cousins is what it said. And, you know, like most people who find out they're donor conceived, they don't know. And so I'm over here thinking I'm dropping this bomb on him. You know, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but this is the truth. We share a genetic father. And he's like, no, that just doesn't make sense. You know, I have a brother. He looks like me. I'm like, don't we all, you know, going through the whole thing. And so he was like, but it says we could be first cousins. I was like, all right, I'll humor you. So that means that your uncle is my biological father, is your uncle Steve. And he's like, no, my uncle is Ken McMorris. My world stopped.
It's because the second time you're hearing that name from.
Second time. And that was the one. I mean, it's a, we live in a small community. This man was always that person in our story. Like, you know, if, you know, he delivered you, you know, in your baby book, page one, this is you in the little plastic bin with, you know, Dr. McMorris, it's a girl. And, you know, the pillar in our community and all, you know, all of that, like you, I knew who delivered me, small town. And I knew in that moment that only meant one thing. And that was that my mother's fertility doctor inseminated her with his own sperm without her knowledge or consent. And he was my biological father. And my mom, we were on vacation and my mom was actually with us. And it was weird in the sense that everything kind of made sense. All those red flags that cognitive dissonance had really taken care of for me. It was like, that's the truth. And so just like when I was 16 years old, I ran upstairs and I told my mom, like, mom, she's just watching a movie. Ken McMorris is my biological father. And she's like, what? Like, have you been drinking? What? And they're like walking her through all of this. And she's like, there's no way. Like, that's Steve is your dad. And so I'm pulling up all my evidence and she went into full blown shock. And I've never seen someone in shock before. She was shaking, asking the same questions, couldn't take information. Mm. And it was heartbreaking because before that I was like, I knew that I had a choice to make because that literally changed everything in my life.
Right. That changes your relationship with Steve.
Changes everything. And I could have chosen to be like, oh, didn't see that. You know, that probably would have been the easier thing, right? But I needed my real medical information for my son because it was no longer about me. And then I'm sitting there thinking, well, what about all my other half siblings? And he probably didn't just do this once. Mm-hmm. And I'm Googling this. And the only other case I could find, well, there was one from, you know, Cecil Jacobson, but the most recent ongoing one at the time was Dr. Klein and Jacoba Ballard and all of that. But other than that, I didn't have any more information. And it wasn't, you know, like we've seen in the last 5 or 6 years, we've seen an explosion of these cases because there's more attention on it. You know, I didn't have that that lighthouse in the storm to guide me. And so I called attorneys and I was like, hey, so this feels like it's illegal. What do I do? Like, I don't know what to do. Do I confront him? Do I send a letter? What are my options? And they came back with me and they said, you don't have options. I'm like, what do you mean I don't have options? Of course I have options. He did something wrong.
Right.
Like,
right.
I want justice. Like, this is not okay. Like, this has affected my child. And he took an oath and he's violated that oath. And so because of the 10-year statute of repose in Texas, I could not bring a medical claim against him. And we also had a statute of limitations issues. I did not find this out 7 years from the insemination. And there was no discovery rule for this. Mm. I found this out when I was 30, not when I was 7 years old. And so there were so many roadblocks with this whole thing. And at the time I was like, okay, there again, back to that naive Disney princess part of me. I was like, well, I want to know who he is. Maybe he will accept me. You know, there was still that abandonment wound. There was still that daddy wound that here I am at 30 years old, starting over for the third time in my life. Who am I? And that genetic identity was so important to me to figure out who I was. But also, I really had to work through a lot personally of my existence used to be this wonderful and amazing thing, you know, for this miracle, if you will, whatever you want to slap a label right on it. But now the truth of it is that my existence is causing a lot of hurt and is painful for the very people that I love. And it's not anything that I have to do, that I did, but I'm still bearing the burdens and reaping the consequences that aren't mine. And so that was a lot to process through, because there's grief work. I mean, there's a lot of work because on the opposite end, I'm getting those marginalizations of, but if you didn't do it, you wouldn't be here. I'm not talking about being alive. I'm not talking about being happy to be alive. I'm talking about the deception around my conception. You know, all those things we hear that are marginalizing from our experience with this. And that's still a really frustrating part I have with this. Yeah. So my lawyers told me, do everything in writing. So you have that. So I sent him letters, and it was mainly just a bunch of open-ended questions. I didn't let him know I had my mom's medical records. I just wanted to hear his, it's kind of like my litmus test. Is he going to lie to me? Is he going to come clean? Right. And I mean, talk about a smoke and mirror show. Hmm. He sends this whole thing of like, I was using a Mylex cup and like a blah, blah, blah. And when the basal body temperature did da, 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 none of this is relevant information. So his story is that he was a donor when he was in college. And he went back to that Galveston school. So he would have graduated about 13 years before I was conceived. And he got his old donor straws. But he didn't know the donor number, but he somehow got those anonymous donor straws and he drove them to Nacogdoches, and that's what he was using. There were five in his program. There were five pregnancies and I think he said two births, which would be me. Mm-hmm. But then I'm looking at all the ancestry in 23andMe and I'm like, there's already three of us. So lie number one. Right. And I don't actually believe that he was able to go get his donor straws and
drive.
I mean, I'm like, it
makes sense.
No, it doesn't make sense. But I think for and him,
I have a question, and I don't want to interrupt your train of thought, but I'm also thinking, like, in the beginning, you had said that largely doctors do this to save money and they don't want to. Mm-hmm. But so did he not have to purchase or get the sperm from California Chiro Bank and then tell them, never mind? Like, I'm just like, there still seems like there would have been. Because California Chiro Bank is thinking that they sold or they gave sperm to this man of donor 106.
And right? They did. That was their check and balance. And there were many purchasing records from California Chiro Bank of Dr. McMorris buying all different kinds of sperm from all different donors. And he was using a nitrous tank, mm-hmm. shipping it, but he was buying a lot at once and keeping it on hand. And his whole thing is I'm passing off the, so you don't have to ship it each time. It was really expensive back then. And he was just keeping it there. So he did buy it. I don't know what he did with it. And so then he was saying, well, it wasn't working well. So I was mixing it. In my mom's records, there were no mixing. It was AID, which means artificial insemination donor. In her previous records, there was AIM, which is artificial insemination mixture, mm-hmm. but this was just straight donor. So I think for him, he was just saying it wasn't working. I think that because he also said something about how whenever his patients didn't get pregnant, it was really hard for him and it was really hard for his staff. So that's why I think there is this kind of narcissistic angle. I think that there is the money saving angle just because I hear all the time how cheap he is as a person. But then I also think that there is this this God complex side of it too. And especially with fertility doctors and looking at, you know, disproportionately a lot of doctors in general, don't hate me doctors, do have some, you know, access to DSM personality disorder type thing. Some of them more so than others. And so I think with a fertility doctor feeding this God complex of when God fails, you come in here, I get you pregnant, I play God. Mm-hmm. And so I think there is a lot of that, but I think that he just really internalized it as he wasn't being successful. I know that he had competitions like with how many babies he can deliver. And so I really just think it was, you know, poor boundaries and poor coping skills and obviously very poor boundaries. Yeah. And so I do think it is really important to note, you know, what artificial insemination entails and why collectively as victims and our mothers being the victims, they say things like, I felt like I was medically raped. And that sexual assault component can be very polarizing with something like this, especially when people think of it as this trauma Olympics of, you know, when you're comparing this to forcible held down rape, you know, it's
right.
Let's not play trauma Olympics. Trauma is trauma. But you know, this is the '80s. I think there may have been a bag phone. Remember those? But like in rural America, probably not. There's no beepers yet. So right. You have this doctor in the middle of an AIDS epidemic. So this is when the ASRM, their guidelines, not their mandates, had to say it had to be frozen sperm for 6 months. So now you have a doctor that's in an OR, that is exposed to blood all of the time, and he's inseminating his patients with his own sperm without their consent. So it's just like this, you know, compounded, you know, problem here. So a woman drives in 30, 45 minutes away. What happens if she gets a flat tire? Like, he's not going to risk that because we know that unwashed sperm can live outside of cervical mucus for roughly 30 minutes, maybe more. And so she gets in, she goes back there, and it may not be, this was not at the time where you had a nurse in there, or you had two people. This is, you know, it just, the landscape was very different. Mm-hmm. So he preps her cervix. He digitally penetrates her with his fingers, preps the cervix, goes into the next room. He masturbates to procure the sample. And then under a state of arousal, he returns to that room, and then he digitally penetrates her again to put his semen inside of her without her knowledge or consent. She could not, there was no assent to this either because she didn't have all the information.
Right.
There was consent to the reproductive procedure. There was not consent to the reproductive material. And that was another legal, you know, thing. But this is why we need really tight informed consents. So yeah, I kind of got off on a little tangent there, but I confronted him and he just lied and lied and lied and lied. And I knew at that point that I was never going to be able to have this genuine and authentic relationship with him because I was always going to be the keeper of his secret. And I just couldn't shake the fact that people were victimized and they didn't even know it. And what if I had a sibling, like I said earlier, who had a child or who was struggling with themselves? I had the information they need to know medically. We know that autoimmune disorders take on average 5 years to get diagnosed and misdiagnosed over and over again. So the only thing I knew how to do or what to do was just to come forward. I still didn't have reach in that community and I knew it was going to be an uphill battle. And so that's what I did. I went on 2020 and I was so frustrated with the lack of legal options that I was like, okay, I'm going to put on my, you know, best Elwood suit and I'm going to go to the Texas Capitol and I'm going to make it a crime. And that's exactly what I did. And so I drove every single week to Austin, Texas, and I talked to whoever would listen to me. And I did not have any bill language. I did not pay attention in government class. I was more worried about my top 10 friends on MySpace.
Oh, yeah.
I did not know what the hell I was doing. But I got really lucky in the fact that Senator Huffman and Representative Click heard my story and they were like, you know what? This is wrong. And it's probably not going to get past this session, but let's just do something. Mm-hmm. California in 2019 was the only state that had some sort of fertility fraud legislation. And that was stemming from the Teresa Erickson case in the 90s, where they were stealing embryos and selling them. And so even that language didn't really fit it. So Senator Huffman wrote this as a sexual assault. And like I said, I went down every single week and it passed the last day of session. And so it became law in May of 2019. And then from there, with my story out in the open, it was like a Me Too moment of I was getting so many people reaching out to me. Wow. Me too. This is my story. And at the time I was like, Cecil Jacobson, Jacoba Ballard, Klein, oh my God, there's more. And so I would send them to DNA or DN Angels, I guess is what I should say. And that is a free service on Facebook and they help you find your genetic parent. And so they would confirm this for me. And then I would talk with them. And then it just kind of became this thing of, well, what do you want to do? And it was important to me to become the person I didn't have. I needed someone to tell me, hey, here are your options. You don't really have any. So what you're going to do? I needed that person. Like, you're drowning right now. I'm not going to teach you how to swim, but here's your life raft. And so and I still do, when people reach out, it's, you know, validating their experience and how messed up it is. And you can come forward and you can be that Jerry Springer sensationalized story. You can change legislation. You can do nothing. There's something for everyone, or you can do a non-disclosure agreement. And we walked through the whole thing about money never making it right. But, you know, there's value in that to you.
Right.
And so, but for the ones that did want to come forward or didn't want to come forward, I still got to use their stories. And so then it became me empowering people and victims to change the legislation in their states. And then we would get one more person on board. And then we would go to the next state. And then the next state. And then the next state. And so in 5 short years, there were 11 fertility fraud bills that had been passed and multiple that had been filed. And then now we have a federal fertility fraud bill that is from Representative Bice's office. And it is a bipartisan bill with, I think as of yesterday, there are 36 authors on it, which is great. And hoping to get that federally passed so we don't have to work state by state anymore for that. Yeah. But, you know, I do get a lot of questions with this as, you know, do you still think fertility fraud is happening? Are you fixing a problem that isn't even there anymore? You know, there is some strong feedback when it comes to these bills. And I truly believe that how we legislate something as clear as fertility fraud, like both sides of the aisle can agree on, that will determine how we legislate other things in the fertility industry in the future. And what I mean by that is that, especially with the overturning of Roe versus Wade, I've had to do a lot of work in separating my work from anything that has to do with abortion or embryos or anything like that. Because the reality is our legislators, most of them, unless they're a woman, they really don't have a great foundation of anything with the fertility industry or the procedures. They don't really know the difference between an IUI, AI, IVF, none of that stuff. And so asking them to legislate something where they don't have any information on, they're not going to do it. And so then you have these huge lobbying arms with the American Society of Reproductive Medicine and Society of Artificial Reproductive Technologies that are fortunately no longer fighting against me, but previously were.
Why do you think they were fighting against you?
Because I was shining a spotlight in all of the dark corners. And I was screaming into an abyss of things that they didn't want people to know. Like, ooh, they hate it when I say this. Did you know that the fertility industry is less regulated than the nail salons? Oh, they hate that one. Or if I say, did you know that American Society of Reproductive Medicine is a professional organization and the dues are paid for by doctors and it's just guidelines? Like, there's no slap on the hand. There's no consequence for not following those. Did you know that, that labs they stop getting regulated at the lab level. So what I mean is when you go to your clinic or your fertility doctor, unless they have an embryologist in-house, then they can do whatever they want. If they want to use a pencil to label your reproductive material, guess what? They can. And so that increases negligence, right?
Right.
And so
switching. We talked about that earlier. Yep.
Yeah, that is the switching. So they don't want me to breathe life and attention into an ongoing problem. They don't want me to say things like, hey, did you know, because we don't have laws with any of this, that most of the negligence part is they're settled with non-disclosures? Or, hey, did you know that a bunch of New York venture capitalists are buying up these practices? And if someone gets into a medical malpractice, they shut that down and they reopen under another LLC, but everything still stays, you know, the same. They hate when I say that one to you. So they basically hate when I point out that the fertility industry operates as a medical services agreement type industry instead of everything else, where you have to go through all the research to get this procedure or medication approved. And you have to go through all these things, but yet the fertility industry is not held to that level of accountability or standard. But us as consumers, everything is so regulated. Like, why would I assume opposite? And then they say, well, but regulations are going to make things more expensive. that's my personal favorite. It's like, okay, so the cost analysis here, if you're going to charge your client $10 more to make sure that they're getting their donor gametes or the correct, their gametes that you've been storing, and you think they're going to say no, or maybe you should look at your policy and procedures of why you're are charging such an obscene amount.
Right.
And then for me to say things like, that there's a 10, live birth limit. I'm like, bullshit. No, there's not. There's no way to enforce it. And they're like, no, there is. That is what the that is what they said. And I'm like, yeah, that's what they said, but they can say anything they want.
Right. The guidelines always get me too. I'm like, they're just guidelines and who follows them.
Oh, my favorite guideline of theirs is, you can have 25 offspring per 800,000 in the population. So I can have over 10,000 half siblings in the US and it still would be under their guidelines, biodiverse. What? Like, I would love to know that, first of all, that person needs to be fired. Right.
And who decided that that was like the number where, you know?
Like, we don't care about like, you know, accidental incest or, you know, wow, that's going to be easy to navigate that many half siblings. You know, we don't care about that. We're just, it's just enough to be biodiverse.
The emotional trauma, the idea that family does mean something.
Shocker.
Yeah.
Yeah. So anyway, those are all my soapboxes and tangents that you got me on there.
I appreciate the tangents. They're,
I have lots of them.
They should be had. I feel like we could make this, we could talk a long time or have multiple interviews and we still wouldn't cover all of everything that should be discussed. So I want to ask you a hard question because it does come up a lot and you hate this question, but what do you say to people other than you're minimizing my feelings when they say, well, you're here now. Aren't you happy that you were born? Like, what do you say?
Yeah, no, that's a great question to ask because you're right. I do hate that question. And people, they say it all the time. And I say to them, yes, I am happy to be alive, but I can have opposite feelings about this. Mm. I can be really upset around the deception around my conception and then also really happy to be here. And those two don't have to go together all the time because what I'm talking about is the deception around my conception, not about my feelings about being alive, because nobody gets to decide how they're born. I get that. But I do get to take control of my narrative and I do get to hold a person accountable if they did something wrong with that. And that is an empowering piece, but I really have to separate it for people when they say that because it's just such this, I don't know if it's just like a cultural thing of, you know, look on the bright side and this like toxic positivity that we always have instead of being like, you know, that really sucks. I get that. It's like when someone passes away, but they had a wonderful life. It's like, no, they were literally an asshole. Like, you don't have to make me feel better. like it's okay for me to be sad about this. Okay. Right. But any like high, you know, anything weird, it's usually just a projection of that person's uncomfortableness about the situation. And they feel like they need to fix it. But the reality is that feelings, they need support. They don't need solutions. Mm-hmm. And that is not, I think, how we look at this collectively as a society.
Yeah. So do the laws that you're helping pass, and hopefully at a federal level, this will come to fruition as well, but do they work retroactively? So maybe there are other folks, I'm sure there are, who will find out in the coming years that they were a product of fertility fraud. Will these laws help them?
So yes and no, that's a great question. So federally, they will not be retroactive because it was not illegal at the time. Now there is a bill in Illinois that I mean Kurt Richardson is pushing through and he's trying to test the waters of that. But it's really hard to convince a legislator to legislate something like that because I don't know if it'll hold up in court, if it gets ever taken to court because it wasn't illegal at the time.
Right.
So that's kind of been the thing. So getting creative for the federal bill, which by the way is HR 451, for all of your listeners, call your congressman, tell them to sign on now. We put in the RICO, and that's the racketeering. That's the federal hook, because if we can get additional charges, additional subpoenaing powers, like for our medical information, like I can't even get that. But right. if this were passed, then they could subpoena that from him and they could get that DNA test and they could get all those things. And I would get my real information, not his bragging list of his social children and how they all do Ironman. That's a whole other story. That was weird. And so that getting any additional wire fraud, crossing, state lines, like those things you could technically do
right.
because it wouldn't be jail time, but it could be fine time. Does that make mm-hmm. sense? Because mm-hmm. it would be fraud, Deceptive Trade Act, that type of thing.
Sure.
But for example, in say Texas, so it's not going to be retroactive. It is now considered a sexual assault for a doctor to do this. We also, in the United States, we don't define, I think it's in 70-something% of our penal codes. We do not define what consent is. We define what consent is not. And so that's kind of inefficient. Mm-hmm. But in Texas, so what else happened is I filed a medical board complaint. And initially, the medical board said this does not fall under the standard level of care for Texas. And so I was like, oh, well, then what does? Like, that is insane. So then they came back and said that they were opening a case for unethical conduct and behavior, which does not carry a statute of limitations, like standard level of care sure. does, which is 7 years. So what happened was, is Dr. McMorris, the board, COVID, of course, everybody was like dragging their feet. This took forever, years. And the board was like, okay, we're taking your license. They tried to take his license. He filed a lawsuit and he filed a restraining order against the medical board saying, you do not have jurisdiction to take my license because of a 7-year statute of limitations under standard level of care. And the board was saying, we are taking it under unethical conduct and behavior that does not have a statute of limitations. So with the attorney general, they agreed because they were obviously representing the medical board. Mm-hmm. He lost the first case. He was like, we don't want to debate the facts of the case. we just want to debate the jurisdiction. So he's lost, I think, 2 times, and he's going to keep going up until he gets to the Supreme Court of Texas. It'll kick back down to the 13th Court of Appeals. And that judge has already said, I'll see you here in 7 years. My ruling is the same. You're going to waste a lot of money. But because he has a restraining order against the medical board, they can't serve him that suspension. So he still gets to practice.
This sounds like a lot of like legal red tape that's doing nothing.
Well, and that pissed me off too. So I went back and changed the law again. And so I go back and so now I've changed the law to where there is a 2-year discovery rule for fertility fraud victims in the medical board compliancy, blah, 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 that any of my new half siblings, if they file a medical board complaint, that they will have 2 years and their complaint will be valid. And it just goes around his argument of the statute of limitations for both sides.
Wow.
So they'll have to wait for the restraining order, but at least that they can get that to a judge and they can probably work around they can get the restraining order
void right.
at that
point. Because the restraining order is how long?
I actually don't know. Oh. That's a good question. I don't know how long it is, but you can take it to a judge and say, here, this is why. It may be hard to argue that he's a threat to the community. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have hit the peak of my legal knowledge, my right. honorary law degree that I feel like I've had.
No, I am so amazed by you and the work that you've done. So as we talked briefly before we started our call, our organization, the Center for Bioethics and Culture, works in all areas of third-party reproduction, which includes donor conception. We talk about surrogacy a lot. And we often hear that more regulation is key to making these technologies safer. Of course, there's pushback that regulation will make it more expensive as well. But mm-hmm. we are of the mindset, actually, that regulation alone doesn't make these practices safe or ethical. There's an argument that more regulation not only will make it more expensive, but it will decrease the supply of sperm and eggs that are available for those who are seeking third-party reproduction to have mm-hmm. their children.
Accessibility.
So,
Yeah, as someone who's working in this space and increasing regulation around this very specific issue, what are your comments then, maybe on a broader scale, on all of third-party reproduction? Do you think regulation, if they do start to actually regulate, do you think that is an answer? Or
yeah, no, I do, only as a deterrent, only that, only because I see the side of it of people settling with non-disclosures. And that's such an easy, it's really easy to talk about numbers when you don't have data for it. And so when the industry can say, well, but like negligence is only like at 1%, it's like, yeah, but we know that the statistic is actually 20% of all medical malpractices and negligence. And so why would you be any different, especially when you have no consistent procedures and protocols? Mm-hmm. So when I think of regulations, I think of, it should be like when you get medicine in a hospital, when you have the wristbands and the technology, and, you know, like when you're giving blood or receiving blood, I think it should tighten up those, just to put accountability, responsibility. And I think that we need to put the people that we are creating from these technologies, we need to put what is best for them. And they don't, not only do they need a seat at the table, but we need to be legislating in a way that is doing right by them. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is, listen, I get it. I know chosen family, and there are certain demographics where this is their only way to have a family. I am very compassionate towards that, and I totally understand that. But there's also another side to that, that this person that you are creating, it's going to be really hard for them. You're making choices for them. You're making that they are going to have 200 half siblings. Yeah. And then we don't have an industry that is talking about how to navigate that. And so, but then you also have anecdotal evidence. When we look at places like the UK, they were worried about a sperm shortage. Did they see a sperm shortage? Not much. And so it's really kind of hard. And I've talked with sperm banks about this a lot, is that, you know, there was a big article in, I think it was the Wall Street Journal, that was talking about, the African American donors, and how there's, you know, it's this crazy wait lists and all of that. So I think that there is a little, there's fear mongering, but I think because there's no real numbers to talk about, there's only assumptions, that it's easy for the industry to operate that, and to operate in a sense under anonymity, but that breeds fraud. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that there has to be a way to hold them accountable in some capacity.
Right.
But then you also have the unintentional consequences of the black market of the fertility industry, where you have the Facebook groups of sperm donors. And there is something to be said about the more expensive and the less access that you have, that people are turning towards very dangerous methods, where predators are thriving in those groups. Right.
I've seen, you know, the, I can't remember what he's called now, but he
which one?
There's a couple of them actually that are, you know, they go around the globe donating their sperm. The Sperminator is one of them.
Ari in New York. So I'm actually going, I'm going to London next week, and I'm filming for a serial sperm donor doc. And it's one of the ones over there. But there's a bunch of them. There's a bunch of them.
Yeah.
And it's kind of alarming, and they're competitive, and it's weird, and it's, and they have hundreds, if not thousands, of offspring. And now Africa is like the new territory that they're all about to start competing over, because there's no laws. And I mean, it's like, it's wild, but there are unintentional consequences. And, you know, when you don't, we have an industry that doesn't educate people or hold them accountable. Like, there is something to be said about that. Like, where is the fine line? With fertility fraud, it's a lot easier, right? Because that is a violation of a contract and the informed consent. But moving into other things, it's more of a slippery slope. And I don't claim to have, you know, the answers to that, but I will always be a advocate and proponent that whatever does happen, whatever does end up being legislated, it needs to be in the best interest of the donor conceived person.
Agreed. We can agree there. Yeah. Well, our time is running out. There's so much information that you've given us and our listeners, and I thank you. How can, you mentioned the bill HR 451, but how can our listeners get involved? How can people learn more? I'm going to include your website, but beyond that, how can people make action here?
That's a great question. I am very accessible. I would say mostly I do everything on Instagram, and my handle is Eve, E-V-E-A-W-I-L-E-Y. So that's Eve A. Wiley. And I check all my like others messages, all that kind of stuff. So you can easily find me there. I post all the calls to action. I give templates on just copy and paste and put your congressman's name and send this.
Okay.
I've had a ton of people who really wanted to get involved and they requested a meeting with their congressman over Zoom. And I joined that meeting and all they did was make the connection. And then I just talked the whole time and then they signed on. So, you know, what is interesting is every single bill that I have passed, so much of it has just been the person that has heard my story or has heard another story and they sent an email, they made a phone call, they forwarded an Instagram post. And they're, you know, that boots on the ground manpower is really what tips the scales because you just got to get a legislator's attention on it. Because once they get their attention on it, they're like, oh yeah, duh. So they're like, oh my God, how is this not a crime?
Right.
Like, but you can help.
Awesome.
So I feel like an info commercial when I'm talking to a legislator. I'm like, no, but wait, there's more.
I just need 10 more seconds of your time. 10 more seconds.
So anyway, that's where you can find me. I get a ton of trolls. So I always love when people send me some positive vibes too.
Okay. Well, it's been an absolute privilege to have you on the show. I appreciate you taking time out of your day to chat with me and to us who are listening and share your personal story. Cause that's, it's hard to be vulnerable like that. So we really appreciate it. You can find Eve too by going to her website, EveWiley.com, EveWiley.com. And I also found her on Twitter at Eve Andrews Wiley. So I'd also, before we leave, like to thank each and every listener and subscriber for tuning in, listening to these stories. Our goal is, as ever, to create conversation, facilitate discussion, and encourage you all to think beyond the masses.
Thanks for listening to Venus Rising. If you like our show and want to know more, check us out at cbc-network.org. Leave us a review on iTunes, too, and join us next week for another conversation on fertility, infertility, and women's reproductive health.